Welcome to Grumpy Strategist, episode 66. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined remotely again by my esteemed colleague, doctor, professor, ornithologist.
Maybe one day colonel.
And Marcus Hellyer. Colonel.
Hello, Michael, and hello to our listeners. So what's on the agenda for this
week? Well, I think we will talk about a colonel, but not you, okay. Another colonel,
all right.
and transparency from colonels. Okay. We can't not mention the war. I think we will mention it a few times, whether we get away with it or not. And then a bit of a deep dive into submarine land with...
Oh, was that a pun?
It was.
Okay. All right, well, I just want to let you know, and the listeners know, that I am calling in remotely. I'm in Udnadatta at the famous Pink Roadhouse.
Yeah, hey, just call out to Elon Musk Starlink for enabling this episode.
Well, like, it's kind of weird. My feed here keeps getting interrupted with this video feed of Ukrainian FPV drones, so there's some kind of glitch there, but on the whole, it's working very well.
There's now, no feed from Russian drones at the moment, though, is there? So that's a bonus. Yeah,
it's working well. I hope the sound quality's good.
Now, you were there a while ago, and I remember you complaining about the price of diesel then. Can you remind me?
Yeah, well, the government is telling us to, not be alarmed about the... It is not a fuel crisis. Don't use the C word.
All the ships that were meant to turn up have turned up, except for the ones that haven't, and the ones that aren't going to turn up later are not something for you to worry about, Marcus.
No, the ships are still turning up. The fact that they all left the Gulf before the war started is...
I can't hear you. I'm not listening.
Anyway, the government's saying, don't worry, it's all under control. So, look, I'm trying to ground truth this. I'm going to tour the country to, put my finger on the pulse, see what fuel prices actually are like,
whether there are fuel shortages.
So I'm going to burn a lot of diesel to explore the situation. I'm in Udnadatta at the famous Pink Roadhouse, $3.79 for diesel.
Whoa.
$3.79, that's the most expensive I've found yet. But I've got a heard a rumour on Tanami track over $4. So I'm off to Tanami and I'll call back in once I get there and let you know what the price of diesel is in Central Australia.
You've got to celebrate something here, Marcus. I mean, a few months ago, you were buying cheapo diesel for about half that price, weren't you? Like about $1.80 a litre or something?
Well, the very day the war started, I found diesel $1.60.
$1.60 a litre. See, now... You're talking about getting up to $4 a litre, and you need to understand you're getting premium diesel now. This is good gear. Like, forget that cheap junk you used to put in the tank. You're getting primo, okay? So there's something to celebrate there.
Well, once I work out the new revised Fischer-Tropsch process and I can convert defence strategic documents into diesel, it'll be ultra premium.
Don't get me back into that.
Ultra premium.
Yeah. But look, I think transparency is a topic we've talked about. You've written about, there's a recent piece from you about the lack of transparency about all things defence.
I literally am still getting over the assassination of the ANAO Major Projects Report.
But there's been a very strong defence of transparency from, I don't know if it's Dickie Miles or Richard Miles. In fact, it might be neither of those people.
Well, look, I think an apology is in order. I'm a big man. I'll apologise. Look, we have kind of made a little bit of fun of Richard Miles, the Deputy Prime Minister / Defence Minister, referring to him as Dickie Miles when he's Defence Minister. All right, let's draw a line under that. Start all over. We will use his correct title from now on.
Which is?
Honorary Colonel.
Honorary Colonel.
As we found out recently from an article written by his former Chief of Staff, who departed under less than ideal terms, he is actually an honorary colonel in Kentucky. He received this title from the governor of Kentucky. It's not quite clear what he got it for, but again, it's not quite clear how Richard Miles ever made it to Deputy Prime Minister, and there hasn't been a royal commission into unpacking that. So we don't need to go into the details of what earned him this esteemed title. Let's just accept the title. From now on, we'll use his correct title, which is Colonel Miles.
Is there another famous Kentucky colonel at all?
I'm not sure what you're referring to there.
So that brings me, I mean, that's fantastic to know that this incredibly august visionary leader has been recognized by the great state of Kentucky in America. I think he was right to accept that honor, and I think it's only right that we respect his new warrior ethos as the Kentucky Colonel.
Now I recall very recently he gave a bit of a doorstop, a mini impromptu press conference. We're looking at the transcript there, and the Colonel was asked a number of questions, and unfortunately we didn't really get direct answers to these questions. But you've done a bit of analysis his rhetorical style.
This is 24th of March, so it's pretty fresh. The subjects were the Middle East conflict, defence capability, the budget, fuel supply and prices. He was asked 11 questions in this doorstop interview.
Right, and how many straight answers did we get?
None. In the 11 questions, in his 11 answers, he used 13 deflections. The most prominent being he wouldn't speculate. He wasn't going to speculate. Of course, he wouldn't expect him to speculate. He wouldn't speculate on either of those things because that'd be speculation. He also used, he's not going to go into a running commentary that, of course.
Yes. He doesn't like providing a running commentary on the Trump administration.
Or anything happening in the world for that matter. He used, I'm not going to speculate. The last thing I'm going to do is speculate. We'll take that as it goes. We'll work through it. And I won't go into details. He left, interestingly, in reserve, and I think this shows great strength of character and restraint, the classic deflection, which is, well, that's a hypothetical, and I won't engage in hypothetical. So he had, I think he felt very confident. Well, this shows his confidence.
In our fuel, we've got fuel reserves. He clearly has deflection reserves.
Yeah. But I thought my analysis is interesting. You know, 11 questions, 13 deflections. I was struck by how much lack of speculation he was engaging in. But I thought, look, let's start applying AI in our work. We've got to do that. Everyone's got to do that.
Everyone's doing AI. We're at the cutting edge. What did AI say in its analysis of the Colonel's rhetorical strategy.
It actually had a longer assessment, but it boiled it down into an overall assessment and a bottom line.
Yeah, just the bottom line. Give us the bluff.
Oh, no, I'm going to give you the bottom line second. I'm going to give you the overall assessment.
Okay.
Across Richard Miles' media appearances, so this is general ones, not just this one from the 24th of March.
The AI's been doing some hard work here, doing research.
Deflection itself is normal and constant for Mr. Miles, but heavy repetition of a single deflection type is not. And then the bottom line for this case is phrases like sensitive national security issues, won't speculate, won't engage in hypotheticals, no running commentary, are all standard tools for Mr. Miles' kit, but they're normally used sparingly and in combination. And the interesting thing about his most recent effort about transparency and providing no information is these deflections are used with unusually high repetition and density, and the particular one about speculation is incredibly prominent. So he's failed to use his broader toolkit of deflection phrases. And the actual complete bottom line AI assessment.
From AI. This isn't us. This is the AI speaking, yeah.
The unusually high repetition and density of this particular deflection by Mr. Miles, the Colonel, is what makes it analytically interesting. Not the presence of deflection, because we know from Mr. Miles that is itself normal and constant, but the pattern of concentrated, repeated refusal language.
So what's interesting about this is the lack of variety or even creativity in the deflections.
He's gotten out a concentrated repeated refusal language.
What I also found very interesting about the deflection here is the referral made by the Colonel to transparency. So he was asked about the fuel crisis.
And what fuel
crisis? Of course,
crisis?
He didn't use the C word. He said, I think we've been very clear about the situation in respect of fuel. The energy minister could not have been more transparent in terms of both the situation in respect of vessels coming into Australia, but the situation in respect of service stations around the country and the availability of fuel. fuel there. Now, that's very interesting. The transparency here is actually not to really get into detail about the amount of fuel we've got or you know, what is coming. It's simply to insist everything is okay. It's an interesting use of transparency, which is to just throw out kind of assertions such as the tankers are still coming.
Yep.
The problem with that line, of course, is those tankers are carrying fuel that left the Persian Gulf before the war started.
I thought it was an incredible example for Colonel Miles to choose to fight to demonstrate government transparency, because Minister Bowen has been transparently out of touch and looks like a fool with his, you know. So 2 weeks ago he said the whole problem is panic buying. There's no problem with Australia's energy supply.
No problem.
He's kept emphasizing the ships that were meant to turn up have turned up. Everybody can see. You know, we've had the tsunami warning. We're all at the beach. There's been a tsunami warning. A tsunami is coming towards us. But just for now, the wave isn't here. And lifeguard Bowen is saying everything's fine. Stay on the beach. All the waves that are turning up are the waves at the normal size. But everybody knows, and I'd suspect Energy Minister Bowen knows, that a global energy crisis is coming our way, and we're incredibly vulnerable because of long-standing energy failures. And that's not because we've embraced renewables.
No, they
haven't. That's because we've had bipartisan energy policy failure for a couple of decades.
They have not been very transparent about the risks.
No.
And the risks are that when our 30-day reserve runs out and the tankers stop coming, is not only will we all be walking, we will all be eating dirt as we run out of fertilizer, and the truck companies that move things around the country also run out of diesel.
But we know what we'll hear now from government ministers, thanks to Colonel Miles. So we'll work through that with our friends and partners in respect of that. I'm not going to speculate on that.
No.
You're asking me to speculate about what plays out. I think we've been very clear.
Very clear.
We'll take that as it goes. So that's deeply reassuring. But Richard Miles now, whether he's a Kentucky colonel, a deputy prime minister, or indeed Australia's defence minister at a time of national crisis.
I've forgotten about that one.
Yeah. I haven't caught up. I don't know if he gave up that title to take up the Kentuckian one.
Well, I think the colonel one's been around for a while. He's had that in his, you know, hip pocket. So.
Great time. I mean, it's a big signal. He's right there with America first. It is a wonderful signal to the population of confidence.
All right.
But that point about energy disruption brings us to the war.
The war.
And I've mentioned it now.
Well, we're using the W word. I mean, you can't use the C word of crisis. In America, you can't use the W word for war, and there are, you know, great pieces out there that I'm sure people are reading or watching, you know, looking, going through the different ways that Donald Trump and his administration have described this conflict.
Well, his Secretary of War can't say that this is a war, which is deep irony.
Well, so Phil Clay, writing in the New York Times, had this great line. He said, "In President Trump's America, there may only be two genders, but our military adventures can identify however they please." As long as it's not war.
Yes.
And, of course, there are many people out there tracking how this war is going and Donald Trump's twists and turns, and how essentially in the space of the same paragraph, virtually, he can say completely contradictory things about his strategy, what his goals are. And, you know, we're all across this, so we don't need to harp on about this, but I think Jason Lincoln's writing in the New Republic just got this completely right.
How did he put it?
He wrote, "Right now there are 13-year-old kids about to invade Kamchatka in their first ever game of Risk that look like Carl von Clausewitz compared to Trump." Speaking as one of those former 13-year-olds, I thought that was hysterical. But it does get at the very heart of this. It's like, yeah, maybe some of the MAGA folk think Trump is still playing five-dimensional chess. The rest of us are just looking at this going, you know, whiskey, tango, foxtrot. What the F?
Yeah. I mean, it's impro theatre, but as a decision maker of a major power.
Yes.
And it's disturbing to see someone that incoherent in that position of power. Yes.
So I don't think we need to go through all the twists and turns of Trump's war goals and shifts in policy. What maybe we can each sort of pull out one thing that mm-hmm. we find quite mm-hmm. interesting, other than the fact that we will potentially all soon be walking and eating dirt.
Yeah, well, you go.
All right. Well, to me it is this. We have spoken for a long time as Grumpy Stratus and before that as analysts at Aspie about the democratization of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So the kinds of technologies that were previously only available to great powers or their clients and customers have now spread dramatically. Now, whether that's quite tactical things about the combination of sophisticated sensors on drones that allow
precision
strike by even non-state actors, we're seeing the spread of missile and rocket technology.
Yep.
So lots of actors are now making missiles. And I thought the reaction to the apparent, maybe
potential,
not quite clear,
possible, purported, alleged,
missile strike by Iran on Diego Garcia, which to me, if you're the Iranians, is a legitimate target because the US is staging long-range bombers through there.
Well, it's a single point of failure that you can inflict on your enemy during a time of war. And if you can, it's okay to sink an Iranian frigate off the coast of Sri Lanka, targeting Diego Garcia kind of looks okay.
Mm-hmm. So certainly from the Iranian perspective, it's a legitimate military target. So they apparently launched two missiles at it. One crashed of its own accord, another one apparently was shot down by an American air defense missile. Again, a lot of conflicting reporting about this. The Iranians are saying we didn't do it, that this is a false flag operation started by the Israelis. Again,
Israelis were first with the news, which kind of plays
into
that.
I'm not quite convinced by that, but let's say it is for real.
Yep.
We still don't really know, was this a real kind of production level missile, or was it something they've kind of improvised out of a space launch vehicle? Not quite clear, but
they're doing their own improv maybe in the war.
But I mean, the Israelis are now going, see Europe, see 4,000 kilometers, you're now in range of the Iranians, so you need to get involved in the war.
It's your war now.
On our side.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. I mean, there has been some response in the commentariat about, holy cow, gosh, we're now all targets and we need to lift our game and our air defense systems. This is an example of that democratization of technology.
Yes.
Everyone is getting this technology now.
Yep.
And I think for the West, it's profoundly disturbing because, you know, since World War II, actually, we, the white people, are the ones who've been able to project power against you brown people there. Now, you know, the Chewie's on the other foot, and it's like the global South is able to respond in kind, and it's profoundly disturbing. Now, you can go, all right, well, we can't just sit and do nothing about it, but countries like Japan, for example, South Korea, have lived under the Chinese missile umbrella for a long
time. A very dense missile threat
now,
for a long time.
And actually, many European states have lived under the Russian missile umbrella for a long
time.
And according to US intelligence reports, Australia is now under the Chinese missile umbrella, not just ICBM, so you know, the nuclear missiles, but conventionally tipped missiles. So this is something that we all kind of have to get used to now and build it into our long-term planning. But to sort of insist that Iran is somehow this evil outlier because they've developed this technology, I think misses the point to some degree.
Well, it does. So one thing I would say related to that is one of the central war aims that the Israelis and the Americans have stated is to remove Iran's missile capabilities, so their stocks, their launches, and their production facilities, so that they don't have a missile capability. But at the same time, Israel has just started a major ground invasion of southern Lebanon because Hezbollah has been launching rockets and missiles into northern Israel. And the reason that they've had to do that is the Israeli military attacked Hezbollah's leadership, just like we've now seen the Iranian leadership attack, and attacked their missile and rocket stocks and production a year ago and had phenomenal success, we were told. But the Israeli military assessed that Hezbollah had unexpectedly rapidly rebuilt its rocket and missile capability and stocks. So they needed to do
Iran
this again.
Just as Iran has after last year's strikes.
So I'm just wondering if Hezbollah in war-ravaged Lebanon can do that after that series of very successful military attacks from the Israelis not so long ago. What's the plan for Iran? 90 million people, very technologically advanced. When their current missile production systems are destroyed, will they be able to rebuild them unexpectedly rapidly as well?
Well, even if they can't do missiles, they can certainly do drones.
Unexpectedly rapidly?
As the Ukrainians did, they were making drones, families making drones around the dining table. Yeah. So certainly Iran can do that. But the other issue here is that if the goal of the war, and as we have seen, the Trump's goal seems to change on a daily basis, but if it is regime change and you do actually manage to achieve regime change, any Iranian government is going to look at history and go, over the last century or so, we've been invaded by the Russians, we've been invaded by the British, we've been invaded by the Iraqis, we've been bombed by the Israelis and been bombed by the US. We are not just going to somehow demilitarize.
No.
Long-range missiles are kind of now a standard part of any country's
inventory.
Military inventory, even including particularly one like Iran, which kind of sees it as the Middle Eastern great power. So saying we're going to insist you give
you
up all your missiles is a bit like saying you can't have tanks.
Yes. Well, particularly in light of the current Israeli government under Mr. Netanyahu, we're hearing from him that he sees Israel as the new Sparta, which was a nation, well, a state, a Greek state defined by war. So if you've got Israel defining itself as a nation defined by war, if you're Iranian, you do need some kind of defensive capability, and missiles and drones will be your go-to thing.
Well, any Iranian government is going to take that line. Yeah. If we go back to the Shah, I mean, the Shah built the strongest military in the Middle East.
But he was our guy. Wasn't he our guy?
Well, he was our guy. So even though he was on our guy, he still wanted the strongest military in the Middle East because that is the Iranian slash Persian self-conception.
Wasn't he even interested in nuclear weapons?
He had a slight interest in nuclear as well, yes. Yeah. Yes.
He was a Maduro of the past.
Mm.
So,
what's your takeaway from recent events?
My takeaway from the war is stop following the incoherent bouncing ball of what Mr. Trump is saying, because he's contradicting himself mid-sentence. And market analysts seem to be doing that. That's why the oil price is bouncing around, but mainly going up. But look at what's happening. So the physical moves are that Marine outfit is heading from Japan. It's at Diego Garcia. It will be in the Gulf later this week. The 82nd Airborne Division is being readied to move to the Middle East. America's flowing forces into the war. That doesn't sound like the war's ending. But the bigger issue, I think, is the Strait of Hormuz is mattering less and less because the broader oil production and civil infrastructure in the Middle East, in the Gulf states, is now sufficiently degraded that even if the Strait opens up magically, which it won't, we are going to be in a longer-term energy crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So back to Mr. Bowen telling us it's all just panic buying. No, we're in a long-term energy crisis and Australia is one of the more vulnerable countries.
Yes, so I think the effects will be felt for a long time. So when Mr. Putin invaded Ukraine, you know, we had another energy, don't use the C word, event. And
excursion.
Yes, so the day Israel, the US, started bombing Iran again, I thought, oh, I'm out in regional Australia, I should fill up. And I found a little local petrol station that had diesel for $1.60. And that was the cheapest I had seen it anywhere.
Yes.
Including Costco, since the invasion of Ukraine. So it had essentially taken 5 years for sort of prices to get back to the pre-war level. And there are many, many informed experts and commentators, senior people in the energy industry saying that this is a much bigger crisis. The damage is much greater than the Ukraine war.
I think even the International Energy Agency is saying that. So we do need to pay attention to that. So that to me is the bigger thing here, regardless of, you know, does a ceasefire happen in a day, 3 days, 2 months?
Mm-hmm.
What does Trump use his limited number of ground forces to do? Does an insurgency start happening? We're already in a longer term global energy crisis.
Yeah.
So now submarines can really help. If you've got blocked sea lanes or someone's trying to block your sea lane, they're like the plumber of the ocean, your submarine. And that's what's so great. tonight about the AUKUS program, but you and I have for a long time now been referring to the great analysis that comes out of US agencies like the Congressional Research Service, the Congressional Budget Office, and some of the stuff that comes out of the UK, their great Navy Lookout think tank, and their government infrastructure projects authority. Unfortunately, most of that analysis, although it's based on very good quality government data out of the UK and US, is bad news for submarine availability. So let's not talk about submarine production numbers. Mm-hmm. I think there's a much broader public understanding on that. Let's talk about availability and maintenance. Yes.
Well, first of all, I'll do a slight detour. So SAA published recently an essay by a smart young man, Ewan Levick, who is the editor of the Australian Defence magazine, and basically looking at the question of, well, we're getting AUKUS, we're distorting our force to get nuclear-powered submarines. How useful would they actually be in the current crisis? And the title said, you know, how many submarines would you need to clear the Straits of Hormuz? Well, of course, the answer is, well, no number of submarines will help you.
Yeah.
You know, so why are we, you know, investing in this capability when they don't really help us? Now, of course, some commentators out there saw this and took the bait and were like, this is a ridiculous piece. I mean, because SSNs aren't about keeping open the Straits of Hormuz. And it's like, thank you, I rest my case.
Yes. Yeah, this just shows how stupid that author was. Well, no, if you read his piece, he said, so the power of asymmetric weapons like drones and missiles for blocking straits and attacking sea lions, that's already manifest and it's probably going to get worse. Yeah. So where's the balance of investment in our thinking? That's what he was trying to say.
So Ewan's point is that, you know, it doesn't matter how many SSNs you have, there are certain missions it can't do for you. But now let's look at, well, okay, we'll accept that, but if AUKUS goes ahead, how many submarines will we actually have? Not just in total in commission, but how many deployable submarines does that
get you? If an Australian Prime Minister says, hey, nuclear chief of Australia's Navy, and not the current one because he hasn't got any, but a future chief of Navy, I want you to send 6 submarines or to sink Chinese warships that are stopping Chinese container ships from getting to Australia. How many can the Chief of Navy offer as AUKUS develops?
Well, it's certainly not 6. So to recap the so-called optimal pathway, if it delivers as advertised, and people have different views on the likelihood of that, first one is meant to arrive sometime around 2032, so a transferred Virginia from the US Navy, then maybe another one 2035, another one roughly 2038 perhaps, so we might have 3 SSNs by the late 30s. In the early 40s, we're meant to start getting the first of the Snorkers. So the UK design boat but assembled here in Australia. But when you sort of project out and sort of think through what that means and you assume certain delivery drumbeats, we probably won't have 8 SSNs, I think, until deep and into the 2050s.
Right. Maybe even the back end.
Maybe even the back end, because we sort of get into that awkward spot where when the Snorkers production line is up and running and submarines are being delivered, our first Virginias are ready to retire.
They're aging out.
So some of those Snorkers are actually a one-for-one replacement for retiring Virginias. So it may not be until the late 2050s or even 2060 that we have 8 SSNs. Okay, so assuming that.
So we've got 8. Let's make that assumption.
We get 8. How many can you actually deploy? And, you know, many people are familiar with the 3-for-1 model. So if you have 3 of something in inventory, you can reliably deploy 1, whether we're talking ships or fighter squadrons or infantry vehicles, battalions.
It's not just, I thought it was a Demtel late night TV offer, I'm getting 3-for-1, but it's the rule of threes.
Three steak knives. And actually, now when we're looking at this, we kind of have to look at the current situation. You know, if you want to sort of analyze the future, well, all you can really do is look at the present
and the past
and project from that. And if you're not saying, if you're saying, well, the present has no relevance for the future, well, then you can't really say anything about the future.
Well, if we took that approach, so the future's unknowable, so if there's trouble in availability and maintenance in our AUKUS partners' submarine fleets, that doesn't mean anything because that's now and the future's a long way off. It'd be weird to discount that body of evidence, but still say, I am absolutely certain that 30 years from now, these particular pieces of machinery, large metal undersea devices will still be the apex predator of the ocean. And I'm absolutely certain we'll have eight in the 2050s. So it would be a weird thing for people to say our current experience that we see with the US and UK doesn't matter, and the last 10 years of operational experience doesn't matter because this is about the future. Well, but be so confident about the benefits and timeline of AUKUS.
Well, discounting the evidence of the past and the present does allow you to pretty much say anything you like about the future.
Yes. Yeah, well, that sounds attractive. Mm.
But yeah. Looking at the evidence of the recent past and present, if we look at our Collins-class submarines, that three-for-one model has held. So in the early 20-teens, Collins availability crashed. The government commissioned the Coles Review, which did a really good job, actually. Got the Navy,
Submarine Corporation,
Defence, yep. The Submarine, Australian Submarine Corporation, everybody on the same page, and they signed up for a model that basically said, okay, here's the kind of contract that we're signing up to.
Yeah.
Six Collins-class submarines.
Yep.
At any one time, two will be in deep maintenance, so they'll probably be actually out of the water, being pulled apart.
Yep.
Four will be available to Chief of Navy, but actually only two of those are deployable because the other two will be in sort of unscheduled maintenance or they'll be in training, they'll be working up.
Yep.
You know, so they're they're not deployable.
So you'll have two consistently deployable out of the six.
Yes.
Yep.
And that seems to the Navy and Defence and Industry seem to have achieved that or come close at least.
Yes, yes. And part of that Coles Review, I mean, there's a great report by Andrew Davies on the ASPE website about this, but part of the Coles Review involved international benchmarking around submarine maintenance and availability. And that one from three model was at the upper end of international best practice. I think they looked at six partner navies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Now, Collins is a conventional submarine.
Yep.
SSNs are not. They're nuclear powered and they're bigger.
They're the apex predator, Marcus.
Apex predator, more complex.
To quote the Colonel, the Kentucky Colonel Miles, and also Vice Admiral General Jonathan Meade.
Grand Admiral Meade,
the head of the submarine agency. These nuclear submarines that we're getting are more complex than the space shuttle and the International Space Station. They are the most complex machines humans have ever produced.
Yes, I mean, the space shuttle's not actually all that complex now. I mean, it is sort of like 70s technology.
I'm just quoting these grave figures.
So when we look at our AUKUS partners to see, well, are they actually achieving the 3-for-1 benchmark? They're not actually. They're not. So even the US is not baked into their system is more something between a 4-to-1 or even a 5-to-1 kind of ratio. So based on the evidence out there, the standard kind of operating model for a US SSN is it does 1 6-month deployment every 18 months or every 2 years, depending on which source you're looking at. So, you know, and yes, the US Navy does have a different operating model to Australia. Like their submarines go off around the world.
Well, that's partly because they are nuclear. And so range is not their defining constraint.
Also, the US is a global power. Yep. It has global commitments. Yep. You know, it has to bomb Iran on a regular basis. Yep. It's not clear we'll be doing that. But that's, I mean, another part of this kind of question is the government, our government, hasn't really said what we're going to be using our SSNs for, other than to sort of say they're better versions of the Collins.
Ooh.
Are we going to be using them like the Collins, and the Collins sort of chuff off from Western Australia, head up north for about 50 days and come back? Is that what we're going to be using our? So not entirely clear, but the US model is 1 6-month deployment either every 18 months to 2 years. So you go, well, 6 months every 18 months, that's 3-to-1.
Didn't you also have, there was a quote about out of its lifespan, like 33 years, how much time do you get it used?
So, but that 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 model doesn't actually take into account deep maintenance.
Right.
So when it is out of the water, up in dry dock, reactor turned off.
Yep.
And so for the Virginia-class submarines, so the current version, the kind that we are meant to be getting in the 2030s, they need to go through a deep maintenance process, which is called an EDSRA.
Yes.
And that actually is meant to take them out of the water for 18 months. But again, if we dare to look at history, it's taking more like 2 years.
Yep. Yep.
So for that kind of, and that happens every 6 years. So it's in the water for 6 years. And in that 6 year period, you may get three, maybe four, 6 month deployments.
Yep.
But then it's out of the water for another nearly 2 years. So that actually turns your 3-to-4-to-1 model into something much closer to 4 or even 5-to-1.
So 5 boats to 1 available.
1 deployable.
All going well.
Deployable, not available. Available is not quite the same thing. So
deployable. Yep.
Deployable, so you can send to the other side of the world. Now, again, that's not us making this up. If we look at, say, the experts in the US, so the Congressional Research Service and the Congressional Budget Service, that's the kind of numbers that they're talking about. So they're assuming over the lifespan of a Virginia-class submarine, I think they were saying 14 six-month deployments
over a 33-year life.
Yep.
Yep. And that's one from four or one from five.
So 14 six-month deployments is the equivalent of 7 years. So over the 33-year lifespan, you get 7 years of deployments. And that's getting pretty close to 5-to-1.
And by the way, that is the desired operating model. So that's when things are going well. And of course, things aren't going very well at the moment.
So they're in, as we know, their industrial base is not in great shape, both for the construction of submarines, but also for the maintenance of submarines. And so there is a big maintenance backlog, plus so we have a lot of boats that sit around waiting for their main overhaul slot, wasting time essentially. Mm-hmm. And when they do go in, these processes tend to take longer. So,
and it's very frustrating for US submarine force commanders, like the Pacific Submarine Force Commander. A recent one was talking about lost years of operational patrolling because of this maintenance backlog.
It's also frustrating for the submariners themselves. I mean, imagine it's like you've served your time, come up through the ranks, passed all of your qualifications, you're now CEO of a submarine, and it's like, guess what? You're going to manage that submarine in dry dock for your 2 to 3 year posting.
Yep, yep.
Fantastic.
Yep. Now, so, I mean, I think this is important, but the root cause to me isn't, oh gosh, a US maintenance contract is no good and are there bottlenecks here and there. It's actually the inherent complexity of the item itself, the nuclear submarine. And as they get more complex, it gets harder to make them available, maintain them. So it comes with the product itself.
Correct. So even if the US industrial base was humming like a top, you know, you might get better than 5-to-1, but just built into the nature of the beast is you will not do better than 4-to-1.
No, so getting 2 deployable, consistently deployable nuclear submarines out of a fleet of 8 is at the level of international best practice and at the level of proficiency of our US partner when things are going well.
Correct.
Now, what about the actual country that is designing and will be building most of the major components of Snorkus, the UK, the Royal Navy?
Well, they do not appear to be getting close to international best practice. And hopefully what they are achieving is not illustrative of what we will achieve.
With the Snorkus
but
product.
But it does show, if things do not go well, where you can end up. So over the sort of the UK, the Royal Navy is currently in the middle of this long transition from a fleet of 7 Trafalgar-class SSNs to 7 Astute-class submarines. They're approaching the end of that transition, at which point they will then need to transition to Snorkers, so it's constant transition. Mm. So, but over the past few years, they've sort of been somewhere between 5 and 7 boats, depending on...
That they possess
in commission.
Yep.
Out of that, you know, again, this is based on the work done by a very good UK organisation called Navy Lookout, so retired former Royal Navy people who are not out to, you know, shoot the system down. They are trying to get a better outcome.
They're
for the
fans
system.
Of the Royal Navy. They've given their service careers to it. They want it to succeed.
But actually what that means is they are going to call it as they see it.
Ooh.
Okay. And when they look at it, they go, well, actually, there have been times over the last couple of years when the Royal Navy has not been able to get a single SSN to sea out of a fleet of somewhere between 5 and 7 boats. And then they might get a few to sea, but it's only for a few months. And then they're back to having none at sea or 1 at sea. And at sea doesn't mean deployable or no, or it means operational.
It means not tied up at the dock.
It means it's not tied. I mean, it may go to sea for a few weeks so they can just do a bit of basic training. And, you know, the other issue with the Royal Navy is you have this vicious circle. You need submarines to go to sea so you can train your submariners and qualify them and promote them. If they're not going to sea, you're not generating submariners.
And they don't stay.
Yes, well, and they don't stay. But if you don't have submariners, you can't take your submarines to sea. If you can't take your submarines to sea, you don't have submariners. And they're a bit in that kind of vicious cycle.
Well, they are. Their first sea lord has recognised this too, and he has actually commissioned an urgent 100-day review of Royal Navy submarine maintenance. Now, I think the 100-day review is only going to do the early first diagnosis of the patient in the emergency department, but at least it's got the attention of their naval leadership. But these are long-term issues. As you say, that this situation has developed over decades. In fact, the Navy Lookout analysts say that it's really a product of disinvestment in the whole UK nuclear enterprise since the end of the Cold War. Mm.
And you have people like a retired Rear Admiral who was a senior submariner.
Director of their nuclear policy.
Yeah, basically saying the entire system's broken.
Yep.
So, again, not saying that is where we will end up. There's nothing inevitable there. But I think what we can say with reasonable confidence by looking at recent history and our partner nations, noting that these are both nations who have been operating nuclear submarines for many decades. Ooh. We are new to this business. 4-1 is the absolute best case, and it can go a lot worse than that.
Now, so which I think makes what's happening with poor old Collins, the actual submarine we have now, you know, more important. You've got to love the one you're with.
Mm.
So 6 Collins, if there's risk in Virginia's being handed over to the Australian Navy, and Snorkus design and production looks very risky because we won't even have our shipyard complete to build Snorkus until 2040, according to the Kentucky Colonel.
Well, some bits of it will be ready by the mid-30s.
Not the bit doing the nuclear
stuff.
But
the nuclear bit more the late 30s.
I'm talking about Area 3. And to me, if you've got a shipyard that's got 3 areas, you need all 3 of them to build the thing that you're building. But, you know,
well,
maybe
to finish it at least.
Maybe I'm, yeah. Well, yeah, getting
isn't
a finish
Area
somewhere.
3 the bit where the aliens are kept? Or that's a different area?
Look, to me, getting a finished submarine is actually what you want when you've got a naval submarine shipyard. But anyway, so there's risk in getting those nuclear submarines separate to this maintenance risk. That means what happens with Collins is really important. So what's going on with Collins and the LOAT, and what options might there be?
Right. So now we're sort of shifting focus a little from how many SSNs can we expect to be deployable to actually overall fleet size. Ooh. Now, as we go through time, we're currently at an all-Collins fleet of 6 boats. In the 2030s, we'll start getting Virginias, and the optimal pathway is, well, 3 if all things are going well, but if Snorkus is delayed, then maybe up to 5 Virginias.
So you're sort of looking, it's 2032, 2035, 2038, roughly, for the 3 Virginias being handed over by the US Navy. Yep.
And then in the early 40s, hopefully the first Snorkus, but if that's delayed, then maybe more Virginias. And of course, there is on the socials, there is endless conversation about, well, not only if 3's risky, you know, that if the US handing over 3 is difficult, then 5 is going to be really difficult. Anyway, so how many overall submarines are we going to have, and what does that mean for Collins? Well, again, if we step back and look at kind of where we've come from, when we were transitioning from Collins to a conventional boat.
The Dirty French.
Yes, that Dirty French boat that we cancelled because apparently it was not going to be fit for purpose the moment it was launched.
Yep.
We realised that we needed to keep Collins going longer than we had planned. Okay, so the first Collins was actually meant to be retired this year.
Ooh.
Okay, and then subsequent ones on a roughly 2-year drumbeat.
Yep.
So we would actually start declining to 5 boats this year, and in 10 years' time, we'd be down to 0 boats. So our get-out-of-jail card, our big strategic risk mitigator, was the LOAT. The life of type extension.
Yep.
So what that would be is instead of a standard 2-year full cycle docking, that would be a big overhaul. We would not only do the overhaul, but we would do a bunch of capability enhancements. So new main motors, new diesel generators. In fact, a lot of the most important subsystems of the boat were going to be replaced.
Yeah, in fact, it was mainly scoop out the steel tube and put a whole lot of new goodness in, wasn't it?
Yeah, so of course some people would then go, well, why not just replace the whole thing? But that's a separate argument.
Aren't heirlooms important in life, Marcus?
So anyway, that
was the plan.
But the plan back then was we needed more submarines.
Yeah,
because we're staying conventional. We just needed more boats. So you want to keep the Collins going as long as possible.
This was the build to the 12 with the French plan. So you're getting more boats and keeping boats was important.
Yeah, the overall strategy is we needed more boats.
Yep.
So if all Collins go through the life of type extension, it's meant to give them extra 10 years of life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would mean that instead of the first one going this year, it would leave in roughly 2038. And then the last one would go in roughly 2048. So we're still well over 20 years away from the last Collins being retired. And at that point, you know, it would be 45 years old. So I'll just remind people that the Indonesian submarine that was tragically lost in training several years ago, it was only in its early 30s.
Yeah, still a young whippersnapper.
And the Argentinian boat that was lost tragically again in training or in transit was of a similar age. So our Collins will be well beyond those kinds of ages.
I think the Japanese retire their boats when they're about 20 years old. So they're always a youthful submarine fleet. Yeah.
So, but if we did that, took that approach, then that would allow us to essentially at least maintain our total fleet at six and maybe even grow for a while as
the Virginias come online.
If
we've still got six Collins, because they've all gone through the life of type extension, and you do get three Virginias, you've got nine submarines, haven't you?
So theoretically, you could get up to seven, maybe eight.
Right.
Because the Collins are not all sticking around till 2040.
Yeah. Okay.
So they're sort of going out as Virginias come in, but there'd be some overlap. So there's a lot of assumptions here about
you know,
delivery drumbeats and things like that. But you could at least stay at six. But then, unfortunately, you're not really going to grow much once Snorkers starts being delivered for two reasons. The first is that the Collins are all gone.
Yep.
So you're down to your three Virginias.
Yeah.
But the other thing is once we start getting Snorkuses, those initial Virginias are now getting old because
They weren't new when we got them. Yeah.
The plan seems to be we're not getting new build Virginias.
Mm.
So by the time we start getting Snorkuses and we start getting Snorkus number 3, 4, 5, 6, those Virginias will start leaving service.
Yeah, because it's getting on to 20 years since we got them and they weren't new when we got them.
Correct. Yeah. So we may not even get to eight SSNs until the late 2050s or even 2060.
And they'd all be Snorkers.
Yes. So,
well, look, a couple of things pop out to me with this plan that you've just laid out. One is the sheer uncertainty.
I didn't lay this out. This is the current plan.
Yeah, the optimal pathway.
In public.
Yeah, but the sheer uncertainty is one thing because we don't know when these different nuclear submarines, Virginia or Snorkers, are going to turn up, really. So part of me thinks, so if I'm a government decision maker, I want to do all the Collins with that big life of type extension because they're my insurance policy. So I want to keep them as healthy for as long as possible. But the problem with that is, A, it's going to take a whole lot of time, money and people with similar skills to the ones I need for the nuclear submarines that are coming. And secondly, aging sophisticated underwater systems can encounter unexpected problems. You know, might open up to Shano and find, I'm sorry, there's just too much trouble. We've got to send this one to the boneyard early.
Well, that is indeed what is already happening with full cycle dockings, where industry is opening up the submarines and going, you know, the corrosion is way worse than we thought. So there's a bit of a potential parallel here with the Anzac class frigates, which we're retiring early because, you know, the effort involved in keeping them going is just not worth it. But there's a couple of issues with this optimal pathway, which I think are worth highlighting. So the first one is, if you put all six Collins through the load and some of them are serving deep into the 2040s, not only do you have overlap between the Collins and the Virginia-class boats, but you will have overlap with the Snorkus boats.
So you're going to be running three different types of submarine. And unfortunately, even with commonality between Virginia and Snorkos, they're going to be different. So three different supply chains, and worse still, three different crewing models.
Correct. So that seems rather implausible. And the Chief of Navy has already said we have more people going into the nuclear training pipeline than we have going into the Collins training pipeline. So I have a feeling that Navy has already made a calculus and gone, you know, that Collins capability has a use by date. We are not going to put more people into that pipeline than we need to.
Yes.
So I think, you know, the ultimate use by date for Collins will be about the early 2040s when we're getting our first Snorkos going well, because you cannot be operating three different classes
in a tiny
submarine. However, I think the end could come even earlier than that, because even by 2040, the average Collins will be 40 years old, which is very old. Now, also, the grand strategy has changed. Before we were trying to grow numbers of submarines, but Grand Admiral Meade has been very public in saying that his task from the government is to go nuclear as fast as possible, i.e. to introduce a nuclear-powered submarine capability as fast as possible. Numbers, it's not about numbers anymore. So if that is your goal, anything that
gets in your way,
you will eliminate. So if we are having competition for resources, whether it's people, industrial capability, or dollars, you will eliminate that.
Your diesel electric submarine is not your priority. Just like in the US and UK, their submarine priority program is each of their ballistic missile submarines, not their attack submarines, the Virginias or Snorkos or Astute. You've got to spend on your priority first.
Yes, and there are very, very few examples of countries that have operated over the longer term, both nuclear and conventionally powered submarines. China has done it, but as we spoke about just recently, it appears they're making the shift and going fully nuclear.
Isn't there another thing? So, you know, this idea of the life of type extension is going to extend the life of the current diesel electric Collins submarine so that we can keep them into the 2040s. But I remember the reason given for going for nuclear submarines with this AUKUS mega program was that diesel electric submarines will no longer be fit for purpose in that future environment.
Yes, even the attack class, which was meant to be the greatest conventional powered submarine ever.
So as far as an actual warfighting submarine capability, our government and defense organizations' position is diesel electric submarines are so last season, you shouldn't have them.
But our current plan is to keep it operating into the 2040s.
Unless it's some kind of, well, I don't want to lose a submarine capability because I've got some industrial and crewing advantages by having an operating capability, I don't get the actual rationale for keeping Collins in the fleet if our government's and Navy's own assessment is diesel electric submarines are now obsolete and vulnerable.
Correct. You know, and also we are absolutely going to have our hands full, both Navy and industry, getting, you know, our heads around, you know, nuclear-powered submarines. So I'm willing to put money down now that essentially by the time we get the third Virginia-class submarine, assuming that comes in the late 2030s, that's the moment we get out of the conventional submarine game.
Well, I'm willing to take that bet, but not with money. I want diesel. And I want that good Tanami track stuff, that primo.
I'm going to put aside for the next roughly 10, 15 years.
I want 50 litres.
A 20 litre, all right.
I want 50 litres.
So that's 2.5 jerry cans of diesel. I don't think Collins is making it out of the 2030s.
All right. Well, store it well, because I'm coming to call in. All right. Thanks, Marcus. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.